Are we awake today for Jameson? Okay, good. I just want to take you back briefly to the last couple of sessions as an entry point to today's discussion. So in the first week, we looked at McInnes and the novel. And remember, in the last session, we were talking about this as well. We brought up some issues about representations of particular spaces in the novel form at a particular historical time about a particular community. Last week, we went a little bit further. We talked about how we reflect on the relationship between history and culture, between various kinds of histories. We paid some attention to the notion of material cultures, the relationship between culture and larger systems that surround it and produce it and are produced by it. And we talked about certain deep-seated ideas that move communities to form certain kinds of identities about themselves. We also, if you remember, ended, or towards the end, we mentioned that the specific problem of how we read certain kinds of cultural styles, not just literary styles, cultural styles, in correspondence to their specific historical moments and communities. That was Williams last week. So today I want to extend that argument a bit further through Jameson. All these people are in dialogue with each other, so often you'll find overlapping concerns and overlapping themes that you've looked at before, but that is kind of the idea, to see how we extend that argument through this. So today I want to look at, remember in Absolute Beginners, we started talking about the notions of beginning, modernity, the notion of the contemporary. That's how the novel starts. I want to see how Jameson today takes that idea of the contemporary and the modern and meditate on some ideas about the correspondence between style and history that Williams had started to talk about last week. So those are your connecting points from last week. I'll end with looking forward to next week's lecture about Buell. So the first thing to I should say a little bit about the title here. Note that subtitle, Reality into Image. Remember, we're talking about the correspondence between representation, whatever that might be last week, McInnes's novel, music, film, whatever it is, and the reality that envelops the representative act. Here, so there was representation, there was reality, and representation was doing its damn best to capture all the nuances of reality. Was kind of the idea we were running it. Note the reversal here. Here, for Jameson, the idea of one of the key features of the world as we live in is the complete absorption of reality into images or representation. Here, in Jameson's analysis, one of the things that mark out our moment and McInnes's moment, really, it starts from that 1950s, 1960s era, is the proliferation of images that have completely taken over, in some ways, reality and is productive of it at a rate and in a way that have never been seen before in history. So when Jameson is talking about reality into images, he's talking about that idea of the turning of what used to be a material, real sphere, reasonably autonomous from the sphere of images and representation, now nearly completely subsumed by it. Okay, so the idea that there was image and that captured some grounds of reality that lies outside that image, for Jameson, that is being eroded over time. And in the moment we live in, what we have is a kind of predominance of images that are now producing reality rather than just trying to imitate it or capture it. And this obviously has a very wide sense of a very wide implication across all spheres of culture and politics. For example, think of that famous leaked debate about just before the Iraq war, about the various kinds, and this is back in 2001, of course, about the various reasons for going to war, at which point one side of the White House administration came out with that line, which is a kind of extension of the Jameson line. We are a superpower now, he said. We create reality. The images we talk about in terms of war, we talk about the necessity of war, those are images and representations, but they create reality. They don't capture it. It doesn't really matter whether they are weapons of mass destruction or whatever it is. The fact that the image of that reality is out there is now more important than the reality itself. So you can see where Jameson's comments on culture is specific in this session to the text that we're discussing, of course, but it has a much wider repercussion. What happens when images take over the production of reality? Think of a film like The Matrix, for example, for those of you who've seen it. The whole idea of reality being there, an image producing or produced by a system that is really concerned about image, the whole cyberspace thing there, is really an image-producing system. What reality is in the matrix is debatable. Once you're in the matrix, remember, everything else outside it is immaterial. You're locked into the matrix. So you see the span in terms of political discussions, in terms of films, in terms of cultural discussions about the preponderance of images that are now producing reality rather than just imitating it. So that's the first key point, the first leap forward, if you like, from the Williamsian idea about culture and material systems. The cultural system, remember Williams had said, is a wide system. Text, it's not just texts, it's about what lies around texts, both literary and otherwise. For Jameson, that has our contemporary moment, or really the moment from the late 1950s, 1960s onwards, is marked by this fact of the cultural system becoming super powerful at a rate that was not really recognized or hasn't really happened in history before. So reality into images rather than images capturing reality. It is a step change, if you like, in the relationship between writing, culture, etc., the whole act of representation and what lies outside it. And for Jameson, this is 1950s London. Obviously, you can see a kind of quite recognizable picture of 1950s. You know, you see the dress, you see note especially the buildings there, as well as the advertisement there, the number on the bus tram. What is that? Yeah. And that bus stop sign. It's a recognizable picture of London. For Jameson, I'll come to that building in a little bit. Why is it recognizable? What makes you think that, oh, that's when things were gray and people were kind of wearing long trench coats and, you know, eating or drinking Bovril? What brings that to mind? What about that picture do you think that you say, oh, this is 50s or 60s, long time ago anyway?
No cars.
Absence of cars, excellent. So you expect central London to have, yeah, go on. Yeah, what about that imagery?
Like the advertising.
Okay. Yeah. So the idea, remember in Williams we're talking about deep-rooted ideas about community, what a community looks like and feels. As a community now, we immediately recognize that it's a deep-rooted idea in us about what London is in the 50s. The advertisement signs, the absence of cars, the dresses, the everything about the building, etc., etc. That focuses on one particular moment of history. And all these things that you see are cultural expressions of a moment. Now, note the difference between that and this image, also of London, of course, a different part of London. Why would you say... Now, firstly, note the building. Does that look different to you from the 1950s building that you saw? And some of you guys have probably hung out there, spent some time there. In what way does it look different? Sorry? It's monstrous, Katia says. It's not her favorite building, and I'm guessing. in the world. But what else? What else about that building says, no, this is not really 1950s. This is more closer to our time. The design of it, yeah? What about the design? Very good. The fact that it's not immediately spells contemporary to us. The fact that it's not in straight line. It's in a weird twist curve. Anything else? Sharp edges, yeah. In other words, they're visual codes. All of you now are using, consciously or not, visual codes about the form and shape of the building to capture a particular historical moment. For you, that is much closer to your own time than the picture that you saw just before. Just if you cut out the human beings, if you cut out the tram, if you cut out everything, if you just look at the building, in other words, the style of the building immediately speaks of a certain historical moment for you, right? You think, oh, that is, you know, that's closer to us, whether you like it or not, whether you think that's a monstrous kind of big South Bank building or not. That's a different thing. It tells us that this is much closer to our time. So, in other words, what we see are received ideas about style, about cultural expression, this building, the material used, the shape, etc., and a notion of history. So the 50s buildings you saw expressed a certain kind of history. This particular, as soon as, you don't need a commentary on this, as soon as you see this, certain kinds of things are triggered in your head that says, okay, so that particular style means that it is our contemporary, you know, it's closer to us than those 50s buildings. So the first idea about Jameson that we started with is the idea of proliferating images that produce our reality. The second idea is the correspondence between certain styles and certain historical moments. Okay? If you look at your handout, your first point is pretty much this, and this is why he insists on not... remember last week in Williams, we were talking about stratification of history, various categories within which historical moments fall into. Jameson insists on that. And here he's talking about what he calls the postmodern in his essay. It is also, this is the second quote, it is also a periodizing concept whose function is to correlate the emergence of a new formal feature, just as you see in this building, in culture with the emergence of a new type of social life and a new economic order. So he's doing two things. He's asking us to think about styles being mutable. They change, they mutate over time. Think of the kinds of poetry and novels that you have read or will read that goes through time, 18th century, 19th century, 20th century, contemporary novels. The fact that they're stylistically different to each other, and this you'll see it very obviously as soon as you read a novel, you'll note, for example, the difference in language, the difference in imagery, in subjects, etc., etc. What he's asking us to question is, now normally we take that as being an authorial choice. You know, Dickens wrote in a certain way. You trying to write a novel today will be aware of Dickens, but also will be trying to make a particular pitch, individual pitch, that marks you out as a novelist, so you will write slightly differently. Okay? So we take that as a difference between Dickens and novelist X, namely you. What Jameson is saying, it's not so much an individual choice, but a range of possible cultural options available at a particular historical moment. So the styles change over period. That much is not in dispute. The question is, why do they change? For Jameson, they're linked to these two things: an emergence of a new type of social life and a new economic order. Think back to McInnes. The narrator talks about the ideas of newness that he hawks around or that he struggles with and sees it typically in the emergence of jazz. Okay, so a new kind of formal feature in culture, jazz in the novel stands in as a new formal a new form of culture. But note how McInnes closely associates the emergence of jazz with the availability of pocket money for teenagers. Who can go to these nightclubs in the novel? This is a newly moneyed teenage class who are patronizing these jazz bars and clubs. So Jazz in itself is certainly a new cultural form, but it emerges out of a new economic context. Namely, in the novel, the teenagers command more money. This is what, remember, the narrator is going on about when he describes himself in distinction to his father, for example. His father is forever saying, I wish I was young now, but I was young in the 1930s when we had no money. You, on the other hand, lucky little sod, you have grown up in an era when you have money. So a new economic order is emerging in McInnes's London. Alongside that emerges a new style. In the novel, it's a jazz. It's the style of music we call jazz. But note the novel. It's also the form of the novel itself. McInnes's own novel emerges in that particular era and takes on a particular form. So, for example, if you want to, in your essays or whatever discussions, if you want to note the correspondence between the form or the style of jazz and the style of McInnes's own novel, you'll have to keep in mind what makes that emergence of the style possible, namely the emergence of a new economic era. That's what Jameson's contention is. And note the other term there, a new type of social life. Okay? A new type of social life, most obviously evident in the novel, in terms of the subcultures and the way that people live, the way that people rent out. Remember, this is the first generation, the teenagers, who are actually living away from their parents. He rents this little shabby room in Napoli in London, which is, for the first time in a long, long time, this is available as an option to teenagers in the late 50s. So not just new money, not just a new economic order, but also a new social formation. He has a completely different set of friends. They form their own tight little subculture. That subculture is then buffeted by the various contradictions and violences of the time, but there are new alignments possible. So three things in that formulation to keep in mind. Styles change, cultural styles, whether it's the building, whether it's a novel, whether it's a film, whether it's a piece of music. Styles change historically. And that change is not so much an authorial choice, although it's in part that. It's a result of a shift in social formations. Think of McInnes's teenagers breaking out of their traditional boundaries of how they live, who they meet, what they eat, how they earn their money. And also a new economic order, the availability of certain kinds of wealth to certain kinds of people. So make that connection now in your head, the shifting of style linked to the shifting of social forms and shifting of economic orders that result in these broad periods that we talk about, Victorian literature, modern literature, 18th century literature, etc., etc. So in Williams, when we were talking about history and style, and we were periodizing it, Jameson gives it a more concrete form. He says, yes, styles change over history. Remember that thing that Williams was talking about, escalators? Now we are up on an escalator. The poetry is talking about this, the poetry is talking about that. Forever, we are talking about a golden era of poetry and the golden era of society, but we can never quite locate it. It's shifting over time. The subjects nominally remain the same, but the utterances change, the modes, the style of the poems change. Jameson is taking it a bit further and making very explicit connection between the changes in those styles and the changes in social and economic orders. So that's your second point about Jameson. First, proliferation of images. Second, the linkages of cultural acts of representation to changes. They're always changing, but changes in economic and social order. So, we come to the third point about Jameson. Who is this, by the way? Marilyn Monroe. Okay. For you, might be a kind of ancient icon you're not really familiar with. No, she's not. Okay. Recognizable?
Yeah.
Okay. What is she reading? Can you make out?
She can't read.
Yes. That's something I'm coming to, yeah.
She's pretty.
Yeah. What is that volume she's holding in her head? Ulysses, James Joyce. So what you have here is the third feature that Jameson is talking about. The modern and the contemporary, let us say the moment from Colin McInnes onward to now, is perfectly, one of the key features of this moment that we're living in, is perfectly captured in that image. Here you have the icon of popular culture, right? Marilyn Monroe, as you can see, all the stereotypical properties of a popular cultural icon are presented, are you know, correct and present in her. Blonde swimsuit, taking a break between probably filming Some Like It Hot or whatever it is. Reading, however, or if we are to believe Katia, pretending to read, okay? An icon of high modern culture, that is to say, James Joyce's Ulysses. Now, what you have here is the erosion of boundary between what used to be thought of as high culture and low culture. Okay? So low, or low in the sense it's popular. So we have these received ideas about what high culture is. For example, if I said, what is a high cultural product, what would you say? What stands for high culture for you? Opera is an obvious one, yes, and a good one. Anything else? High culture? Shakespeare is high culture, okay? You might have to battle with Carol later on, but yes, we'll take it. Shakespeare is standing in for high culture. What else? Shakespeare, opera, anything else?
Ballet.
Ballet, okay. Ballet. What else? What else do you take for high culture? One more. Classical music. Okay. Now, what would you say? Okay, before we get to low culture or popular culture, so we have those four elements, ballet, opera, classical music, and Shakespeare. What would you oppose that to in terms of difference, in terms of the very opposite of that, namely low or popular culture? Let's have four items of contemporary popular culture that you would oppose against that.
Street dance.
Street dance, okay. One, as opposed to ballet. Yeah. Popular music as opposed to classical music. EastEnders as opposed to opera. Okay. And what would you put against Shakespeare?
Comics.
Or they have a posh name now, don't they? Graphic novels. Okay. So comics, let's say. Let's use your proper name. Now, what you see is automatic notions of complete opposition and difference. There is Shakespeare, there is comics. There is ballet, then you have street dancing. There's a notion of exclusive difference between these two spheres. On the contrary, what Jameson insists that we think of is our times, the time of modernity, contemporary, postmodern cultures, whatever you wish to call it, pretty much starting from when McInnes was writing, right down till now, is marked by the gradual erosion of the borders between the two. Okay? In other words, it is perfectly possible, and in fact, this is a fairly well-known photo of Marilyn Monroe. The idea that this hits a nerve, it hits a chord in us. We don't find it utterly ridiculous. We might find it funny. We might find it quite amusing. But we don't find that possibility of Monroe posing with James Joyce an utter improbability. Okay? The idea is the coming together, the physical proximity and blending of high and popular cultures. Think of, again, McInnes writing an entire novel, really, about subcultures and jazz. And remember, the novel form itself mutates over time. Those of you who will go on to do a course called Euronovel next year, one of the things that Graham MacDonald, who teaches there, starts by saying, the novel form was really the Heat magazine of 18th century. It was really pretty much an icon of popular culture in 18th and 19th century. Well, it is not the form that we take it to be now, you know, heavy literary novels that garner lots of global prizes and are a marker of literary prestige. That is not what the novel was, you know, 150 years ago. So over time, what we have seen is a gradual coming together of the spheres of what we take to be popular cultural products with the notion of high culture. Suddenly, jazz is respectable. Jazz started really as jazz was the equivalent of street dancing in the 1920s and 1910s. Suddenly now, when we go out on Friday evenings and Saturday evenings, you see, you know, slightly strange blokes slunking off to jazz clubs. You go, oh, God, they're boring jazz people. Forget them. we're into whatever you're into now. Jazz has come to stand for a certain notion of high culture. So what is popular becomes high. What is high becomes popular over time. And that shift takes place due to a particular logic of spending and earning in society and of new social formations. That's your third point to keep in mind. The erosion of boundaries between Marilyn Monroe and James Joyce, if you want to put it that way. Okay? The fact that you look at a Monroe film now and call it a classic, you know, Some Like It Hot, for example, it has happened over time. What used to be fairly, to use a crass term, a trashy example of Hollywood in the 50s or 40s or 60s even, late 60s, 70s, have come to stand in for Hollywood classics, classic films. So in other words, think of this when you treat your literary authors or some canonical books or whatever you're asked to think of in terms of reverence for high culture. Think of that eroding boundary. At some point in history, something happens. And what used to be canonical texts or high cultural expressions become streetwise and popular cultural. Okay? Those boundaries shift. For Jameson, that is a sign of our times. The acceleration of the rate at which high culture becomes popular culture and vice versa, that is a sign of our times because of the way of certain ways of consuming, earning, and living. Okay, so whenever you deal with questions of canon, of high culture, of popular trashy culture, etc., think of them not so much as immutable categories. Think of them not so much as categories that don't change over time. That, for example, if Shakespeare is a very good example in this case, what we take to be canonical high culture now is really quite a subversive, trashy, bolshy, popular cultural type in Elizabethan England. For example, the theatres couldn't even get a license to run a theatre in the city. That's why they had to huddle by the river, which was outside the city jurisdiction, because they were really flesh pots and really kind of sin pits. You know, that is where dissolute people go to have their hit of Shakespeare a month. Okay? So Shakespeare is a bit like, you know, kind of enticing illegal drug around that time, right? You've got to go by the riverside to get a hit. Now, of course, RSC is orthodoxy. It's a byword for respectable culture. If you tell your mum I'm going to spend an evening not street dancing but going to Stratford to see RSC, she'd be very pleased, right? She'd be like, okay, that's great. You know, you're already, it's like going to the opera. It's very good for the parents. So do use that line if you're going out. You say, oh, I'm going to RSC, and then go and do whatever you want to. But you usually get away with it. So in terms of, think of Shakespeare as a category. Such a revered category now was really, in every sense of the word, on the margins of society not so long ago. So that this is a fact that happens over time. What Jameson is saying, and has happened in every society over time, what Jameson is saying is about the acceleration of that rate. How quickly what is popular and what is classic, what is popular and what is high and what is low, how quickly they change. It's the rate of the change that he's talking about. Not the fact that this doesn't happen over time. It happens to everything and everyone. But the rate of the mutability is much greater now. Really from the period of the late 50s that we're talking about. So whenever you participate in this debate, think of Marilyn Monroe with James Joyce, which is a very weird thought, actually, when you come to think of it. She has finished the book. Yeah, she's only a few pages off. And that is, I have to say, that is much better than what most of us do with Ulysses at first attempt, right? So think of how good Marilyn has been with Joyce. The fourth point about Jameson's argument. So the third point was about the erosion of the boundary between low and popular and high cultures. The fourth point, and this is really key, this is where we enter Jameson's discussion about style, contemporary style, really from late 50s onwards to now. He thinks of style. So style has changed over history. Style has changed as a result of the erosion of boundaries between popular and high cultures. Style has changed due to new social formations and new economic orders, teenagers having more money, for example, just the general fact of wealth and society. All this, if we gather all this, what we get in terms of our contemporary culture is that term, Jameson uses that term, pastiche. Okay? Now, any of you... Okay, I'll show you another picture, actually. So, take a good look at that picture. Right? And then take a good look at this one. Now, one of them is by a bloke called Pablo Picasso that you might have heard of. Right? How many of you have heard of Picasso? Okay. One of the classical high cultural people that we now take of Picasso, you know, great artist, blah, blah, blah. At his day and time, of course, revered as a, vilified as a slightly wild playboy and an avant-garde artist, right? Okay, so which one is Picasso, do you think? This one or the previous one? The first one? Can we have a show of hands on this? So is this Picasso? How many of you are saying this is Picasso? Bold show of hands, please. About 15, 20 of you. How many of you are you saying that is Picasso? All of the rest. How many of you are undecided? Okay. That's a good indication because quite a few are undecided about which one is the real Picasso. Now this is one of the real Picasso, by the way, is this one. Not that one. But that, for Jameson, is a key feature of our contemporary culture. That is to say, this consciously, very consciously, cites an older work of art, that is to say, Picasso's, which has real charge and real... It's a painting called Three Musicians, as you may have guessed. This particular painting is consciously attributing a certain kind of style to Picasso. It's imitating it. It's citing it. The difference is he calls it pastiche. So this for Jameson would be pastiche, and it stands in for most of cultural products today for Jameson. The point is it's blank parody, that is to say, it's a parody without humor for Jameson. Now, think of those two things. Picasso, this is the original. If he's parodying previous artists at all, he has, for Jameson, a concrete stylistic gesture that is suffused with humor and irony. Okay? Picasso is making a particular point of his own artistic inheritance, is breaking with it, and is showing how definitive that break is with a sense of sardonic sarcasm, humor, irony. Here, if you look at the other picture, and I don't want to go into kind of, you know, detailed stylistic comparison of two. Here, Jameson's point is, it's still imitation, it's still citation, this time he's citing Picasso, but this time it is done without any distinctive sense of what it is as opposed to what Picasso was. In other words, it is blank parody. It is a parody without any point in it. Picasso's parody, if it was parody, is a gesture of artistic autonomy. This is a tradition. I am taking some stuff from it. I am definitively different from it. It has a sense of its own idiom, if you like. It has a very developed sense of what it is. Okay? For Jameson, one of the things of... And that is Picasso, as you know, high modernism... 1920s and 30s, for Jameson, that is what is missing in the cultural output today, and we'll come to why in the concluding bit. The cultural output of today, sorry, that's back to Melon. Shit. The cultural output today is the level still right, by the way? The sound man has left. Anyway. I hopefully won't be marched out and shot by the university. Anyway, past the definitive feature of cultural products today is a lack of sense of its own unique specificity. It's busy quoting 10 other sources without giving you a sense of how it is different to those things. Okay? So he calls it blank parody. He calls it pastiche. That stands for Jameson, most cultural products from, let us say, late 1950s onwards. In other words, what you have, going back to that first point about proliferation of images, cultural products today are a collaboration or a collage or a pastiche of images available to it from all different styles and eras without a sense of what today is, what its own unique specificity is. That is Jameson's point. Now, I want you to both recognize that and argue with it, okay? And think of McInnes's novel in this case. Is it a novel that we can very easily subsume within the category of pastiche, that is to say, blank imitation of previous styles? Or is it a novel that forges its own style to show up all other stylistic innovations apparent to him? Is it a pastiche? Is it a parody which is blank? Or is it an ironic gesture that retains the sense of its own uniqueness? For Jameson, the majority of cultural products today, not all, and this is an important point because in Williams we were talking about the particular role of, let us say, novels or certain cultural products in retaining both the sense of its own history and the history that precedes it. Jameson says that has faded. Most obviously has in mind buildings, architecture, and music as being mindlessly and banally repetitive. Contemporary music, okay? You just have to think of, I don't know, the top 20 chart, for example, okay? Chart music. How many of you listen to that program? Do you still listen to top 20, top 40, or look at it? Or do you just go kind of MySpace? What? This is not confession. I'm just trying to get a sense of this. Who? Okay, show of hands. Who actually has any ideas about what top 40 is or chart is? Okay, very good. Yeah, very good. Fair sprinkling. Now, if you look at chart music, it's a perfect example of what James is talking about. That is to say, imitative, repetitive music. I'm not slagging top 40, by the way. This is Jameson's word. Musically speaking, the four-minute pop gems that you get, right, really are a recycling of styles that were in fashion not so long ago. I mean, you look at any of the kind of hit chart albums, a lot of them cite consciously other songs, quite often even by themselves in the previous album, okay, and recycle that as a hit, as it were. In other words, if you look at a contemporary musical hit, it is mostly composed of citations from other songs, stylistically speaking. Of course, they don't actually repeat other songs, not least because the copyright laws will land them in hot waters and they'll have to pay out a lot of money. But musically and stylistically speaking, there's not much to distinguish them from a pop album from last year, for example. That is what he's really getting at. A popular style that is composed of citations and quotations from a variety of other styles without making any distinction between itself and the previous artistic forms. That is what really Jameson is calling pastiche. So the point about contemporary style to think of when you think of in terms of the Jamesonian take on contemporary art is how much of it is pastiche? Do you agree with that analysis? And how much of it, or are there art forms that retain their own original status, own originality, at the same time as they mark their distance between their previous artistic inheritance? In other words, are there progressive and radical styles, cultural styles, available to us today? If so, Jameson is not saying they're not. He's merely saying that the scope of them have reduced over time, and he gives, and that'll be a final point, he gives a concrete reason why they've reduced over time. But are there cultural forms available? When you read a contemporary novel, when you listen to a contemporary bit of music, when you look at a film, are there, within that artistic space, are they making a gesture that's really making a solid stake about what they are and what they're commentating on, in other words, their own artistic autonomy in relation to the other stuff that they are consciously quoting. That is something that you have to decide as cultural critics yourself. And the grounds of those judgments that you make are really what Williams, Jameson, McInnes, etc., are interested in providing you with. Okay, what makes a pastiche? What makes a contemporary classic? What makes a pastiche? What makes a real, ironic, sharp, parodic cultural product? So the idea of blank imitation, blank parody, parody without humor, that is what Jameson is really talking about. And for Jameson, there are two, and as I said, this is your final point, why that should be two. There are two explanatory categories for it. One is linguistic, what he calls contemporary linguistic disorder that he somewhat provocatively calls schizophrenia. Now, you'll have heard of schizophrenia, obviously. Note what that cat is saying in the little thought bubble up there, right? They pick up the pieces of America's disposable culture and turn them into beautiful obscenities. Okay. So what the point of that, you know, slightly, actually quite disturbing picture of a kitten is, firstly, it's suffering from a linguistic disorder. Note the spelling of the novel. This, of course, will be very familiar in terms of text speak to you, right? So next time you text someone, think of yourself as participating fully in a culture that's diagnosed as schizophrenic, right? In other words, that is to say, the idea of words, the words that you're texting or talking about or thinking of in terms of this kitten, the idea of words being unmoored from what used to be their traditional meanings, both in terms of form, various kinds of spelling error, but also in terms of the link it makes into pieces of America's disposable culture and beautiful obscenities. Now, those two ideas of obscenity and beauty, of culture being turned into beautiful obscenities, etc., those are not really, normatively, how we understand culture, the function of word, beauty, etc., etc. The fact that that has broken down, both in terms of a sentence and in terms of a thought process for Jameson, is one of the first signs of what we might say a linguistic breakdown in our cultural zeitgeist, right? The fact that words for us, the overabundance of words, the words in their various forms, the words in the various shapes, the words in various spellings, words spelling out stories, words spelling out various kinds of multiple images that come at us from every angle, the superabundance of images, and the resultant breakdown of the normal relation between words and things, what used to be thought of as a fairly stable relationship, that is no longer available to us precisely because we have so many choices. You know, just look at the word culture there. We can spell culture and be understood as denoting something in a variety of ways. That particular word is no longer stably moored to a stable idea of what culture is. That is the first sign of what Jameson calls schizophrenic culture. So think of McInnes's narrator trying to make sense, trying to develop a new language to express his reality. The old language will no longer do. He can no longer talk in terms. Note the emphasis McInnes had on slang, for example, in the various subcultures. These slangs or new ways of speaking, you'll be aware of this, of course, the emergence of slang as a particular subcultural style denotes a kind of a lust for identity for that particular subculture, in the case of McInnes' teenagers, but also denotes in a breakdown in the traditional understanding of what words, languages, etc. can do. In other words, they can no longer provide McInnes' new teenage narrator with the kind of identity that was available for his father, for example. So one of the first signs of schizophrenic culture is a linguistic proliferation on the one hand and a breakdown on the other. The more the language is available to us, the more the languages are available to us, the more meanings proliferate and the less stable the relationship between language and things are. Images, remember, or the matrix, if you want, have overtaken what the reality is. The reason behind that, and this too is found in McKinney's, remember the number of people the narrator encounters who are into this new media, new forms of consumption, new forms of buying, selling, and becoming rich, that is anchored to their sense of who they are. The idea of proliferation and availability of styles for Jameson is directly tied to what he calls new modes of consumption. This is your final final quote in your handout. New types of consumption, he says, planned obsolescence, an ever-rapid rhythm of fashion and styling changes, penetration of advertising, television, and the media generally to a hitherto unparalleled degree throughout society, the replacement of old tension between city and country, etc. Now, hand on heart. Right? Hand on heart. Is that such an alien thought for any of us? You know, how many hours do you, just out of, again, this is not confessions time, how many times would you say that you go shopping in a week? No, this is not basic shopping. This is not shopping for food. You know, I shop, therefore I am. How many times, really, honestly? Twice? Thrice? Once? Three. Sorry? At least once a week? Okay. Four times a month? Now, what we're talking here is an emergence of a new compulsion. You know, this is obviously a slight exaggeration of, you know, I shop, therefore I am. But the idea of shopping, this actually sounds very strange to people of a different generation, shopping being a social activity. The fact that, you know, Saturday afternoons, hey, what are you going to do? You know, go out and shop. Why not, right? The idea of acceptance of that as a central activity in our lives is fairly recent, if you think of it. It's not that old. This wasn't available as an option to people inhabiting a slightly different generation. This is directly in other words, the sense of who we are being tied to an idea of constant consumption. Quite often, how many times have we gone to a shop, not because we really need anything, but because it's quite nice to look at stuff that's available, right? You know, stuff that's just come out, the stuff that the newspaper I've seen advertised, the stuff that, you know, somebody has said, this is cool, and this is what's in this season, for example. We don't necessarily go to buy it. We just go to have a look and then walk out without buying it, mostly because we've run out of money because we've done so much other shopping, right? The point is, the fact that that is tied to a sense of what we do as regular activity, as an everyday activity, is fairly recent. The idea of new forms of consumption, I shop, therefore I am, for Jameson, is linked to this idea of availability of 1,000 different styles and 1,000 different kinds of cultural resources that we use almost without thinking, but without pausing to analyze the relationship between that and where we have come from and where they have come from. In other words, the relationship between history and us. Where have we come from? What is our past? Is subsumed for Jameson under this constant compulsion to be forever modern, forever present. So he calls it presentism, the idea that we must inhabit the moment and we really must make ourselves access all that is available to us. When I say shop, I don't mean just clothes, but also styles and novels and cultural products and the ways we think. That is a fairly new phenomenon, and that is what lies behind the idea of pastiche as a contemporary style, but also the idea that of constant beginnings. Remember, going back to absolute beginners titles, absolute beginnings, absolute interventions into our own reality. The point that we are, the idea that we are starting off, every moment that we live is a new one. That is a fairly new historical phenomenon driven going back to your first quote, by ideas of new consumptions and new social formations. In the case of McKinney's teenagers, in the case of our times, we can name any other various kinds of formations of subgroups and subcultures that we can think of. So next week, we will complete this unit by talking about the correspondence. Remember, we're talking about material culture. Today we talked about styles, history, new social formations, new economic orders. Next week will be very specific. Lawrence Buell is talking about the correspondence between culture and style and literally the material space that they come out of. Think of McInnes's London, the buildings and the society, and how McInnes's novel was written. And we'll have a discussion about that next week to end this unit.